Okay, thanks, Tom. I guess I'll start by sort of introducing what we're going to do and saying this would be the part of a program where you would respectfully give somebody a moment of silence because they're not here anymore. But since we're talking about Phil Durst, that would be wholly inappropriate to give Phil a moment of silence since he was never silent. He was brilliant and irreverent and passionate and probably the highest rated speaker regularly at the UT seminar. I miss him terribly, and we have tried to do Phil justice by coming up with something that gives us ethics hours, but is as irreverent as Phil might be. And so what we've done is we've created an ethics game where Jane and I will play each other. We will try not to use profane language, but I think Jane's more at risk than I am. And we will ask a real ethics question, and then we will give what Phil might say. And what Phil might say can either be correct or incorrect. So you get to guess along with us when Phil is being irreverent, or us channeling Phil is being irreverent, then it might be a correct answer and it might not be a correct answer. And with that, I think Jane gets to ask the first question, so I'll shut up.
Okay, so let's see this next slide, please. So question number one posed to Daryl. You represent a client pursuant to a contingent fee agreement that provides for a fee of 35% of any amount received. In the judgment, you recover for the client a money judgment portion for $50,000 plus the discharge of a $250,000 mortgage on their home. Are you entitled to a contingent fee on the amount of the discharged mortgage? And Phil, what would Phil say? Let's show that. Phil, you won the benefit of a discharged mortgage for the client. Of course you get a fee on that amount. Daryl, you think Phil's right?
I think Phil is funny and he's wrong.
Let's show the real answer. You are correct. You're limited to a contingent fee on the monetary portion of the judgment only because it is not clear that any amount received includes non-cash benefits like loan forgiveness. Because the lawyer is in a better position to describe the fee arrangement than the client is, the burden is on the lawyer to include such matters clearly in the fee agreement. And in all these slides, the source, whether it's a DR or a case or an ethics opinion, is going to appear at the bottom. And some of them are going to be cases that I have lost. And that's how I knew what the rule was now, because I lost the case.
So this category will be called, How Would Jane Lose It?
How would Jane lose it? What would Phil say, and how would Jane lose? Okay,
right.
Let's get the next slide.
Next question, are omissions of material facts in appellate briefing a violation of Texas Disciplinary Rule of Professional Conduct 303's duty of candor? Because Phil would say whatever that means, whatever the duty of candor is omitting a material fact of violation. And Phil would probably say, it's called advocacy, dummy. Why would I ever include material facts that hurt my client's case? That's called malpractice. Jane, what do you think the real answer is?
I think, once again, Phil is funny, but Phil is not correct. Let's show the real answer.
Appellate counsel does have a duty. I like Phil's answer better personally.
I mean, it's not telling a lie.
And in these trying times when the truth is so fluid, it makes perfect sense to me.
There you go. Let's see the next slide. If you are tried and convicted of a crime, can you sue your criminal defense lawyer for malpractice? Let's show, what would Phil say? Sure, why not? And you'll have plenty of time in prison, in the prison library, to do your research. What do you think about that, Daryl?
I think, yes, you can. But I think it's an old, I can't remember the case. The first case Hughes versus Peeler and I don't know. Did you lose that case, Jane?
I did. Let me show the real answer.
So show the real answer.
Yes, you can sue, but only if you have been exonerated of the crime on appeal or in a post-conviction proceeding. If the conviction is vacated on grounds other than actual innocence, then you have to prove your actual innocence of the crime as an element in the legal malpractice case. So that's Gray versus Skelton is the one I just lost earlier this year. And the issue of you have to be exonerated. And the question was, what constitutes exoneration? And does it have to be before, you know, as part of the conviction being vacated? And so yes.
Since this is your area of expertise, can mm-hmm. I have a question? Since it's your area of expertise, can I ask a question?
Huh.
Is a pardon the equivalent of an exoneration?